This program may impose some cerebral responsibility on the listener.
This is an official station of the MAEB.
MAEB.
The Michigan Association of Educational Broadcasters was formed in 1977 to support your local high school and college radio stations. These stations serve the community and create alternative programming. But most importantly, they discover and train the next generation of broadcasters. For more information on the MAEB and its affiliates, visit www.maeb.org.
Here's First Lady Michelle Obama and Justin Verlander of the Detroit Tigers for Let's Move.
There are so many fun and easy things we can do to be healthier.
First, set aside an hour a day to get up and play.
Second, play can be anything. Catch, tag, just running around.
Third, eat healthier. It's key to the whole game plan.
Everyone can play. Visit letsmove.gov and get moving.
A message from Let's Move, USDA, the Ad Council, MLB, and the players.
Hi, this is Amy Milan from Stars, and you're listening to WHFR 89.3 in Dearborn, Michigan, the station making waves.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Can Diane teach your parents well, their children's hell?
Welcome, and thank you for joining us in the WHFR studios. I'm Margaret King Ahmed, the Parent Involvement Educator in the Dearborn Public Schools, and your host of Parent Connection. Parent Connection is a monthly program here on WHFR that is designed to keep parents connected with helpful tips and information that will empower and support your efforts as parents, the first teachers of our children's growth and development. I hope you will gain new insight and resources that you can add to your best practices for your parenting toolbox. In the studio with me today is Jill Matthews, special education teacher consultant. Jill has been in special education since 1983. She has taught in the classroom at the elementary and university level. Jill has supervised undergraduate and graduate practicum and student teaching placements. Jill, welcome. Welcome, and thanks for taking the time today to be here with us at the WHFR studio.
Thank you, Margaret. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jill, where does a parent go to get help? They are looking for services for a child who is lagging developmentally or typically not matching developmental growth charts and scales.
Well, the first place you start, Margaret, is always with your pediatrician, whether you have a family pediatrician or you use a clinic, because doctors are trained to look at development of a child, and they're going to be the ones who are going to be able to say that, for example, a child's motor skills or language isn't where it should be given their age. They also have that knowledge of the child medically, so they know if there are other reasons why something might be happening. For example, a child who was born prematurely or a child who has had other medical factors. For example, my youngest son had a lot of ear infections when he was a child.
Yeah.
So when he was 2, he wasn't talking. And when he was 2.5, he was rambling on and on, but no one, including myself or my husband, had any idea what he was saying. And it was because of the ear infections and having fluid in the ears. And that was something that could be corrected medically and just resolved itself over time.
Okay. Well, how many test evaluations does a parent need before a diagnosis is determined or decided?
Well, that's a big open area. A lot of it depends on what type of diagnosis you're looking at, if there are medical factors involved, if there are any kind of other factors. It might be genetics. for example, with Down syndrome or Tay-Sachs or any of those things. It could be a medical issue. As far as developing in terms of language, there are a lot of environmental factors that you look into, too. Anything from something as simple as being the youngest child in a family and having all your siblings talk for you, which really isn't a disability, but could come off that way.
Right, right.
To a child who just isn't getting the concept that language is how we interact with each other.
Right, right. So there's physical signs as well as the
absolutely
medical and
absolutely
emotional.
There are physical signs, there are behavioral signs, and depending on what's going on with the child, there may or may not be a disability, and if there is, sometimes it's really hard to kind of separate that out.
Right. And with parents not having all the resources or the information, could it be possible that parents sometimes contribute to maybe this isn't the right word, but a disability? Do you think they cater to it? Do you think that they somehow support it, or they're not sure and they just treat it as if it is a problem and it's really not a problem, but they support it in their behaviors?
I think we can all do that, maybe, maybe subconsciously.
Yeah.
You know, I firmly believe that all parents want what's best for their own child.
Right, right.
And we want to protect our children. We want them to be the best they can be. And sometimes, I know I protect my kids sometimes more than I need to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Having had two children who have had some special needs. I mentioned that my youngest had speech problems and hearing problems. My oldest has autism.
Okay.
Specifically Asperger's syndrome, which is supposed to be on the higher functioning end. I hate to term it that way, but that's how people know it best. And there have been times when I was more protective than I might have been of another child.
Right, right. Now, in some of the testing or evaluation, it happens at the doctors, and then it also happens in the school districts. Where does a parent go once a doctor gives them a medical diagnosis, and then they go to school with that child? Then what happens? What's the follow-up for a parent in a school?
Well, the first thing, let me give you a little bit of history on that.
Okay.
Michigan was one of the first states to have any kind of special education services.
Okay, back in
In 1972.
Okay.
Our first special education laws were enacted in Michigan, and they were very comprehensive and actually are still on the books today to cover birth through age 26, or up until the 26th birthday.
Okay.
Which is, you know, much more than we would expect of a typical youngster attending school.
School,
we think
right.
of five years old, they start kindergarten, around 18 they graduate.
Right.
That's their school life.
Okay.
So the Michigan rules acknowledged that additional need, both with the early intervention, the birth to five,
okay,
and with extending the educational life of a child, if you will.
Okay.
Those rules were mainly aimed at children and young adults with much more severe disabilities. At that point, they were talking about what was then called mild mental retardation.
Right, right.
You know, we now call it cognitive impairment.
Okay.
Before that, it was mentally impaired. Okay. But also in dealing with children with some pretty significant physical disabilities.
Okay. But did the law, I mean, back then, when it was implemented, was there a lot of help for kids back then? Do you think there's more help today in schools than there was back then when the
law there's far more help today. Okay. First of all, we've learned a lot, and we acknowledge that there are more disabilities than just cognitive and physical impairments.
Okay. Has it always been the rule to keep them in-house or to inclusion instead of a child being pulled out of a classroom?
No, it really hasn't. Okay. You know, the pendulum has swung in both directions.
Right.
There was a time in the 60s and 70s where children with more significant impairments were often institutionalized.
I remember that.
Yes. Plymouth Center for Human Development was one of the largest institutions in the state for people with mental retardation. Those days are behind us. We don't institutionalize children simply because of a disability anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, with your own experience with having someone with special needs, I mean, can you look at it now and say how important that is to bring people into the limelight and people that are of special need into, you know, public, and they should be treated very similar to everybody else? I mean, it's for their personal best and growth, and even our own.
Absolutely. And I think the special education laws in the state and at the federal level have both reflected that.
Yeah.
The most recent push in terms of the federal legislation, or the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, is toward least restrictive environment,
right.
Which means, you know, the less is more kind of thought, where we don't have to separate children in order to educate them appropriately.
Good.
So that little bit of history being said, the federal laws went into effect in 1975.
Okay.
So a little bit after Michigan. Federal laws cover ages 3 to 21.
Mm.
Not as much of an age range there.
Right.
But there was a caveat in the law that said that age 3 to 21 or the age range that is given by any previously existing state rules.
Okay.
So Michigan is still covered in the birth to 26.
Okay. All
for
right.
that reason.
Do we take the lead in that, covering people with special needs?
We really have.
Okay.
Like I said, we were one of the first who had those laws in effect on the books. In fact, okay. I had a great aunt who was teaching at the time when the state law went into effect. So I got to see it kind of from the outside in terms of, you know, what did Aunt Ethel do?
Yeah. Right. Well, let me ask you this question. If a parent is not satisfied with outcomes and evaluation findings, what is another option of course of action a parent can pursue?
Well, it depends on where they're dissatisfied. Obviously,
okay.
if they're looking at a medical diagnosis, you know, you always have the right to go for a second opinion
right.
in terms of medical findings.
Okay.
One place where parents can go and doctors can refer, or outside agencies can refer as well, is what's called Michigan's Early On program.
Okay.
Early On is part of the Michigan Department of Education, and it's designed to identify and provide a resource for parents who are looking for services for a child who may have a disability.
Okay, and it doesn't matter what district you're
in.
As long as you're in Michigan.
In the state of Michigan.
Okay.
Exactly.
And how do they find, what do they have to do? What do parents have to do to get to that site?
Well, they can do a couple of things. First of all, they can go to if they're in Wayne County,
mm-hmm.
They can go to www.resa.net.
Okay.
And they can look under special education.
All right.
And find the resources that are available to parents there. There's a link with a drop-down menu.
Okay.
Or they can contact early on directly.
Okay. How do they do that?
And they can do one of two things. Either 1-800-EARLY-ON.
Okay. 1-800-EARLY-ON.
Mm-hmm. Or they can go to the Early On website, which is www.1800earlyon.org.
All right.
So either way, they can make a referral that way.
All right.
As I said, outside agencies, mental health agencies, clinics can do the same thing there as well.
Okay. And then we can give those sites again at the end of the show.
Yeah.
I think that would be helpful. What are the typical transitions parents and family members go through when raising a child with special needs?
Well, it's very similar, Margaret, to the same steps that someone goes through in terms of grief for someone who has passed away.
Okay, can you explain that?
There were a lot of studies done in the early to mid 20th century, sociological studies. Dr. Kubler-Ross was the most prominent one. But where they talked about stages of death and dying.
Mm-hmm.
And what she found in her research and what has been confirmed in subsequent research is that people who are going through, for example, a long-term illness, where they're in hospice or something like that, as well as the loved ones associated with them, go through a series of stages or steps in order to deal with a loss, in order to deal with their own grief.
Right, right. Well, and it does take so much more out of a parent emotionally.
Oh, absolutely.
And mentally, when raising someone with special needs.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I can understand that being kind of a grieving almost.
It is a grieving, and I think it's even more in some ways because we're not used to culturally or as a society, we're not used to grieving for young children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where our expectations are. That's where our hopes and dreams are for the future.
Sure, right.
Is with our children.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're hearing that you may have to be altering those or your child may not be able to fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a toll on a parent.
Yeah. And I find, too, that parents sometimes become almost captive in their homes because it's so much work and effort to get the family out for an outing, even going to a restaurant. I think you said something to me back about a week ago about how, you know, sometimes some of the parents bring in their kids and some with the special needs don't know always how to act because it's just too much stimulation, and they might just have a seizure or a fit or something might happen that they'll feel embarrassed about. But that, you know, it's interesting. I think it's all about sensitivity. It's about building sensitivity, not just from the parent's point of view that has the child that is special needs, but the people that are out there in public as well, in the restaurant. I mean, would you agree that it's everybody. It's like the whole village raises the child, right?
Absolutely. And we've gotten away from that concept of it takes a village.
Yeah.
You know, as fast-paced as society is now with the number of moves that the average family makes while the children are growing up, you don't have that small-town sense that I grew up with.
Right, me too.
And I grew up in pretty small towns.
Okay.
I used to joke with my students over at Fordson when I taught there years ago that my hometown got its second stoplight after I graduated college.
Wow.
Yeah, we had as many in our high school in four four towns as any one of our local high schools has in one graduating class.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we got to take a break. An important message is going to be shared with you in just a minute, so stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Hey, what's up? This is Tim from Alistair, and you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves.
Welcome back. If you're just now tuning in, I'm Margaret King-Ahmed, your host of Parent Connection in the WHFR studio. With me today is Jill Matthews, special education teacher consultant. Thanks for joining us. We left off in the first part of the show with talking about parents and families and the transition they go through when raising a child with special needs. So, Jill, my question to you is, what are some options for parents when they feel emotionally and physically drained?
Well, Margaret, I think every family is slightly different in terms of just their family structure, the friends of the family. I've worked with families who live here and have no relatives in the area, no one to support them other than friends that they may have made more recently, and they may not feel like they can rely on those people for a lot of support. On the other hand, I've worked with some families where there are aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents, and there's a lot of support there. And that's, I think, the first step is looking at who are your natural resources in terms of who are the people that you can rely on to help you out in a pinch, to be there if an emergency happens, or even if you just need to go out and have coffee with a friend and get away from the house for a while.
Right, right. Now, what about in the schools? Is there support in the schools? I mean, once the child's in the school, and then I guess the parents are open for more free time.
Yeah, a lot of the time, you know, school is used as a time when the parent can get kind of recharged and get a breath of fresh air. And that's true with whether the child has a disability or not.
Exactly.
I've known a lot of parents who mom has given up her career or put it on hold, for example, while the children were young. And once the youngest gets into school during the day, then she feels like she can go back to the other part of her life because she knows where her kids are and she knows they're safe and can handle that. So that's part of it. When you have a child with special needs, I think you're always on a little higher alert level. I know with my oldest son, my son who has autism, I've always had that little bit of alertness. His teachers, social worker, counselor, all through school, always had my phone number at the ready. Mm-hmm. I was the go-to person. So that was part of it. I actually had a social worker once joke with me that when he left her building, she could take me off speed dial.
Oh, be disconnected.
Yeah, disconnected.
So there is a lot of transition, and there's a lot parents can do to help themselves, and they have to be willing to do something and take those steps to support themselves through this whole process, because it's very emotional. Being a parent is very tough these days, and I know it's even more challenging when you have a special needs child, but
One other thing I wanted to put in there, too, is that when you don't have those kinds of supports, there are community supports available, whether it's through community mental health or it's associated with a paid daycare or I hate to use babysitting service because even as children get older, sometimes we need that break from them as well. But there are other services out there. Like I said, community mental health is probably one of the biggest. Looking at the mental health field in general, quite often they'll provide things like respite care, where they may provide some time so the family can get out, can go do what they need to do. Sometimes something as simple as taking an hour off to get your hair cut or go shop for groceries without taking the children.
Yeah, some of the things that we might take for granted, you know, that are just everyday, daily routines. People with special needs children don't get to really perform that way. And so, yeah, the support is everything. Jill, what happens in the beginning of a school year for parents who have children with special needs? Will the process play out the same way as it does for other children starting the school year?
Sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. In fact, often it does. I think the longer a child's been in school, the more normal the beginning of the school year gets to be. I don't know if normal is the right word.
Right.
But, you know, the more you're in the routine, and that's not just for the kids to be in the routine, but it's for the parents too.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are those concerns, especially when you have a child with a disability and you're sending them off to school for the first time, and maybe they're 3 or 4.
Mm.
That's a big step, and those buses are big. It's one thing for the school district to say, oh, yeah, absolutely, your child, you know, would be eligible to come to our specialized preschool program, and we'll provide the transportation. The bus will come to your house, pick them up. Maybe they've never gone on a bus before.
Mm.
Maybe they've never gone anywhere without mom or dad or grandma before.
Right.
And the child might be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean the adults are, because we get a little nervous too.
So what happens for mom and dad as they transition through the child leaving the house all day?
I've had some parents who choose to drive their own children so that they get that closure. They've delivered them to the teacher. They're much more comfortable with it. Then they can go ahead and do what they need to do. I've had some parents who the first week of school wait until the bus pulls away from the curb and then go out to their car and follow the bus.
Well, I guess it takes all kinds.
Yeah.
I mean, you do what you have to do to feel comfortable, I guess, and it is. It's like the cutting of the umbilical cord. You really are like letting go a little bit and backing away a little bit and letting this child have some independence, and that is so difficult to really wrap your head around, because it is not something that you're used to seeing your kid do. So it is about the routines, like you're saying, and getting kids comfortable and yourself comfortable.
Absolutely. And it does get easier for parents, but that's a huge jump to make that transition. And there was just something else I was going to say about getting on the bus, and I forgot.
Well, here's something I want to tell you, though. One of the things I see even in the regular school day is parents carrying backpacks for kids. And I'm all into independence, and even kindergartners can carry their own backpacks. But I guess it's that whole separation that we're talking about here with parents and kids, and the kids going off and doing their own thing, and the parents then having to figure out what their own thing is. And now that the kids aren't home, I mean, a lot of us typically will go home and do our work and take care of the house and do the shopping and maybe go home and go to bed because we're just so darn tired, you know, because we work from morning to nighttime taking care of things. But I think it's really important that as parents, whether you have special needs child or not, that we learn as parents to let kids be independent. Let's not teach helplessness. Let's move them forward. Let's let them do things for themselves. Everything should be a safety net. You know, we can let them try and take the initiative, and if it doesn't work the first time, then they problem solve how to make it work the next time. But I wanted to ask you, do parents experience a sense of guilt? And what are some ideas we can share with our listeners that would empower the parents and support them through that transition stage and working through guilt?
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to parents, and it's usually mom because she's typically the one who is staying home, if a parent is staying home with children. And there's that sense of needing to protect and needing to work with the child and devote your life to making things better for your children. And there is some mommy guilt associated with that.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times when I'm working with parents of young children, one of the first things I say to them after we've talked for a while and I get a little flavor of how they're doing, I'll look right at them and say, drop the mommy guilt. Mm-hmm. We're done. Drop the mommy guilt. You're not guilty of anything. You're doing what's best for your child. That might mean that you're not the one actually physically doing whatever it is, whether it's the occupational therapy or the running the preschool or whatever. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do that.
Well, it's interesting because that guilt thing is that probably you spend so much of your time dedicated to that person that once that person is out of your sight, they're not out of your mind.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, and so there is something about that. I mean, it's the same thing that we were talking about earlier on in the show, even about mourning, grieving, kind of the grieving thing. So I don't know. Do you think there's responsibility on the school administrators and educators to help really reach out even more so to the parents that are in these kinds of situations or have children with special needs?
Well, I think the schools and the teachers, the programs, anytime people are working with children with special needs, I think there's more of that component in the program than there would be with a typical child anyway.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we know as educators is that the better the communication is between school and home, the more on the same page we are, the better the outcomes are for the children.
Yeah, the more solid it is. Yeah. And I'm thinking that like we have PTAs in the schools, or PTOs or PTSOs. Is there a special group for people with special needs? Is there another kind of a group or association or that works specially with the special needs parents?
Actually, there is. There are several of those organizations. Here in Dearborn, we have a special education PTA. Okay. Which is specifically for parents of children with disabilities. At the county level, that's referred to as a PAC, or a Parent Advisory Council.
Okay.
And parents of children with special needs can belong to those organizations or can contact those organizations. Again, at the county level, they'd want to go to the RESA website.
Okay.
The www.resa.net, and look at that drop-down menu for parents.
Okay.
And they could look at the Parent Advisory Council there. Most larger local school districts also have something like Dearborn has. There's a Parent Advisory Council, for example, in Livonia, where I live. There's a PAC in for Plymouth Canton schools. The other counties, the intermediate school districts typically run those programs as well. So even if you're from a smaller town, depending on which county you're in, there's something out there. Also, the special ed rules require us to provide information for resources for parents.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
So anytime a parent receives any kind of communication from the school in terms of giving consent for an evaluation or attending an IEP meeting or going in to review testing, any of those kinds of things, they're given a packet, and it includes the parent's procedural safeguards, mm-hmm. what their rights and responsibilities are under special education law. It also includes those resources, and those are typically more specific to a disability.
Okay. One last question I had for you on this is, what are some of the questions that parents should be prepared to ask when before enrolling their child with special needs into a school? How can they be prepared? What are some of the questions they should have for their administrators or when they walk into the office and talk to the secretaries? What kind of questions do they want to ask?
I think it's a little different if you're looking at an initial evaluation.
Okay.
With that, I think rather than, every parent is going to have questions about anything to do with their child, just naturally.
Mm-hmm.
If it's an initial evaluation, typically parents will come in and they'll say something like, well, do you think he, she has whatever the suspected disability is? Right now, obviously, we're getting a lot of referrals about autism because mm-hmm. there's a lot of information floating out there on the web, on TV, on radio, right, about autism.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's really kind of a difficult thing to pin down in a lot of cases, you get a lot of questions about, well, he really likes the swings. He'd like to play on the swings all day. Does that mean he's autistic?
Mm.
So you get that anxiety level
right
raised up.
Right. Well, I guess more of the questions that I'm looking at are, how are you going to provide for my child? What are some of your services here? What is the setup here? Can he get from point A to point B without taking the steps or going up the steps? And those kinds of things, like getting some kind of an orientation around the school. What are the questions that parents should kind of have ready to ask when enrolling their child in a special needs, as far as teachers go and people with the right training and things like that?
Well, I think you're on the right track with asking about the questions. What I would suggest is that rather than asking questions, the parent comes in and talks just about their child and what they do with their child and where they see their child needing help. And then you can make a plan together to work with that.
Okay. And we're going to stop right there and be right back. We're going to take a commercial break here. Thank you.
Hey, this is Annie Stila, and you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
Welcome back. You're listening to Parent Connection on WHFR. I'm your host, Margaret King Ahmed, parent involvement educator in Dearborn, and my guest in the studio today is Jill Matthews, special education consultant. She's joining me today to address and share with you the concerns that parents have with raising a child or children with special needs. Thank you Jill, again, for being here. Jill, we were last speaking before the break about being in the schools and making that transition as smoothly as possible with our children, whether with special needs or not, but in this case with special needs. So I guess the best way for a child to feel like it's going to be successful is to start in the school year, in the beginning of the school year in the fall, the parents taking the child into the school, walking around the school, meeting the people in the building, the secretaries, the people that run the building, meeting the teachers if it's a teacher that they're meeting for the first time, or revisiting the teacher that they had the previous year. I don't know. Would you agree that that might be the best way for anybody really to start up school?
I think that is the best way, Margaret. That's why so many schools have kindergarten roundup in the spring, so that parents and children can come in and meet the teachers for kindergarten, meet the principal, the secretary, get to go to their new school, and get a little more acclimated. I think it's even more important when you have a child with special needs sometimes to do those same kinds of things, especially if it's a child who really hasn't been out of the home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. So listen, here's the thing. We were talking probably a week ago, and you let me know that you were raising two children with special needs, and you talked a little bit about how challenging and complicated that can be. And you mentioned to me these two phrases, fair is not equal, and disability is not an excuse. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. Fair is not equal. Fair isn't equal. Fair is getting what each individual person needs. To put it in a more day-to-day perspective, I wouldn't expect you to read a book without your glasses.
Mm-hmm.
You need your glasses to read the book. I wouldn't expect someone with a broken leg to run a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
They have a broken leg. They might be on the sidelines. They might be doing something else, but they may not be running right now. Some disabilities are temporary. Some are more permanent. But fair is getting what each of us needs in order to be successful.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I do a parenting class, and that's one of the things we talk about. Parents often say that's the comment that comes up in our class, it's not fair. It's not fair. The kids are always telling me it's not fair. And you said it quite well. I mean, it's not about what's fair. It's about needs. Who needs
exactly
what?
Exactly.
Okay. And then you said disability is not an excuse. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's not an excuse. We talked, you had mentioned earlier about fostering independence in our children. And that's all of our children, not just children who are growing up typically, not just children who have disabilities, all children. We need to foster that independence. And if we teach our children either by saying it or by example that they can't do something because they have a disability, they won't be able to do it.
Right.
Because that's the expectation. The expectation becomes, I can't, I have a disability.
Yes, we have that language in the parenting program. We talk about this I can't language, which really leads to helplessness. That's
absolutely
what that leads to. So I think you're right. I think that's an important message to give to parents right now, is that I can't language is helplessness. And I like that idea of leading by an example. Either it's spoken or it's actually demonstrated. That speaks volumes for people that are learning for the first time.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Mm-hmm.
It all goes back to that. You have to have that example, and it has to match what you're telling the child or what you're telling another adult. Similarly, you had used the example of kindergartners going off to school for the first time and parents carrying their backpacks in for them.
Right.
Another step. Oh, you can't do this. I have to carry it for you.
Mm-hmm.
My younger son played hockey for 7 years. And when they're little and they have all of that equipment, and especially when they're a goalie like my son was, they have even more equipment. There's that thing, especially on the hockey mom's part of, oh, that bag's as big as you are. I need to carry the bag for you. What else do I need to do? How do I need to help you? I think the best advice I ever heard about parenting came from a hockey coach.
Oh.
He stood outside of the locker rooms one of the first days of practice and stopped every mom that had a bag. And he looked at her and he would say, if he's big enough to wear it, he's big enough to carry it. Put the bag down.
That's brilliant.
I thought it was. Never.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I think that's the practice we need. I find even in the schools, kindergarten, back to kindergarten, the teachers will stand there at the door to welcome the children, and the parents want to come right into the classroom because they're excited. I mean, in some ways, they're big kids. They just want to go back to kindergarten and see how things are in the classroom and see what the kids are going to be exposed to and what kind of things they might be working on and where their child's going to be sitting and, oh, and so on and so on. But really, that is well said. Kudos to that man who said that to you. What a great lesson. I tell parents that in my parenting class, too. We really want to do everything we can to set kids up for success, and the way to do that is not to overfunction. And we typically want to do that as parents. And you said that, you said, Jill, earlier about how mothers typically do that even more so than the fathers. So that's interesting. But go ahead, you can tell us more about your children.
Oh, let's see. Well, my oldest son is 17 years old and graduated from high school
congratulations.
A week ago.
Thank you. That's so great.
We survived.
Yay.
So he's off to college next month. He's starting the summer term in July. So we're pretty excited.
Okay. Is that close to home or is he going to be?
He's going to be driving, yeah.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Okay.
Yeah. So that's been a long haul. Now we're facing that transition of, for the last 13 years, mom's been on me about making sure that, you know, I did everything I needed to do for school, and I've had teachers telling me I needed to do these things, and I've had counselors telling me, and I've had parents telling me, wait a minute, this isn't just like summer vacation. I don't have any homework. I don't have all of these other things. It's a bit of a transition that we're going through right now.
Oh, wow.
And then my second son is 15.
Okay.
And he's a freshman in high school. So he's going through finishing off his first year with final exams and all of those kinds of things. So his anxiety is way up because of exams, and his brother's is way down. So you can just imagine the interactions that are going on at my house right now.
You just have to stay right in the middle, Jill. Right in the middle, right?
They're old enough to stay home by themselves now. I just need to stay out of the house.
Well, we were going to talk a little bit about autism. We were alluded to it earlier. And you told me in a conversation that autism is not a temper tantrum. What did you mean by that statement?
Well, autism is a neurological condition. And along with that, quite often the person with autism, whether it's a child or an adult, can easily get overwhelmed with their different senses, sight, smell, hearing, taste, touch, just their environment, temperature, all of those kinds of things. And they may not always have the verbal skills, even if they're quite verbal otherwise. When they get overwhelmed like that, they may not have really the ability to communicate or to even label what they're feeling at the time. And so, especially in younger kids, you get things that look like a good old-fashioned two-year-old temper tantrum.
Mm.
Throwing yourself on the floor, screaming, kicking, whatever. And that's one of the most difficult things for a family to deal with when they're out in the community, because the people around you don't know that your child has autism.
Mm.
They just see a child, in some cases maybe a child who's much older than your two-year-old, throwing themselves on the floor, screaming, kicking, biting, throwing things, whatever. And they're trying to communicate, but the other people in the area aren't seeing that as a type of communication. They're seeing it as brat.
Mm-hmm. Tantrum.
They're seeing it as a tantrum. They're seeing it as, you know, you have a brat, and the people look at the child differently, and they especially look at the parent differently.
Mm, and we talked about that a little bit earlier on in the show, how, I mean, you know, it is very difficult when a child, you know, stoops to that level of communicating, and it is a form of communication, whether it seems prehistoric or not, it doesn't matter. It's that the parent is also going through something very emotional at that time as well, because she wants to or he wants to understand the child but can't quite understand them because the communication is not, like you're saying, a verbal kind of communication that we might see typically. So I can understand now where that guilt feelings come from, and where people feel ashamed, and they don't want to be out in public. And I can understand that now. I mean, it's not pleasant. It's unpleasant. And that's the thing that is so puzzling to me, because it's the person on the outside, the observer seeing it, doesn't realize how uncomfortable it really is for even the parent, and maybe even the child that is having this kind of this meltdown sort of thing, you know, trying to communicate what they're really feeling or experiencing at the time.
I'm glad you said that, because it is uncomfortable for the child too. And the example I like to give to help people understand that whole sensory sensitivity piece is, imagine that you are in the Mall of America on Christmas Eve, biggest selling day of the year.
I don't want to think about it. I'm just kidding.
You have all of the crowds doing all of their last minute shopping.
Yep.
There's all of the roller coaster and all of the rides and things that are going on in that particular mall. There are flashing lights. There's music being played.
Mm-hmm.
There are announcements. Now, it's already pretty overwhelming, right?
Right. Oh, my gosh, yes.
Okay, now, the announcements are going to be in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some kind of interference over the PA system, so that there's a rattling or clicking kind of noise that isn't stopping.
Mm-hmm.
The heating system isn't working properly.
Mm.
So the heat isn't shutting off, and it's about 75 to 78 degrees in the mall.
Now, somebody that is that sensitive, somebody with autism, that's a sensory overload, right? That's just what that is right from the get-go. They can't even be focusing on buying the gift and who they're buying it for, or if they got the right amount of money. They've got all these other ambience, or not even ambience, but outside interference with their thinking.
Exactly. They've got so many things going on that they really can't focus on what they need to focus on. And you or I or anyone else in that situation is going to be very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Someone with autism may be uncomfortable to the point where they can't even tell the person next to them what's bothering them because
right.
they can't sort it all out. It's just too much.
And that's when a tantrum, kind of what we call the tantrum thing, might happen?
Yeah, typically that would be a time that would be prime for a meltdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's actually usually in working with people with autism, we think of it as a meltdown.
Okay.
Just like a nuclear reactor.
Sure. Yeah, right, exactly. Well, it's interesting because I was thinking how overloaded I was feeling just from you mentioning those things. And I thought, geez, I don't even like going into a mall when it's that much is going on. And it's the same thing in a classroom, too. We were talking earlier about classrooms and teachers and making that whole transition. I find sometimes in classrooms we have too much stimulation in a classroom, and we find that kids are really having some behavior issues around it. And I had a question for you, Jill, about is it possible to diagnose someone with autism later in life in opposed to earlier in life? Is it something you just have, or is it something that develops based on this even overload? Okay.
Well, we know that autism doesn't develop.
Okay.
We know that you have autism or you don't have autism.
Because it's neurological.
Because it's neurological.
Okay.
It doesn't develop. The difference being that depending upon how significant or how serious the symptoms are,
mm-hmm.
it may not look a lot different with a younger child, but as the child gets older and those gaps in the development or the differences in the development get larger,
mm-hmm.
that's when you start to suspect that, oh, maybe there is something else here.
Okay. We got the 3-minute warning here, and I had a couple more questions here. I guess the one thing, maybe we can close with this. There was two questions I had. One was, how do we build tolerance and understanding in the public and at home and school to embrace differences in one another?
Well, I think a lot of organizations have started doing that. As far as autism goes, the major organization out there called Autism Speaks
mm-hmm.
is the one that's very, very much on the forefront of autism awareness. That's where the ribbons with the puzzle pieces all come from. That's where the public service announcements come from, is from Autism Speaks. Part of it is just being open and honest and saying, this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And being willing to, as adults, at least acknowledge that that's something different, because going back to what we said earlier, too, if you have the model
yeah.
from the adult, the child's going to follow that.
That's great. We have a couple websites we want to leave you with today. The one that we talked about earlier was about Your Family Has Rights, the Early On program. You can contact them at 1-800-EARLY-ON or log on to www.1800earlyon.org. And Jill, you have a couple there that you want to mention?
Yeah. The other one, if you're in Wayne County, would be www.resa.net, RESA.net, and that would provide information for parents as well.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to say in closing today's show, Jill, thank you so much for being here and being our guest today. And Roger White, our producer, thank you very much. And Jay Cornick, our student advisor, thank you here at WHFR for your continued support and outreach to the community. I'm Margaret King Ahmed, your Parent Connection host. Take care.
This is an official station of the MAEB.
MAEB.
The Michigan Association of Educational Broadcasters was formed in 1977 to support your local high school and college radio stations. These stations serve the community and create alternative programming. But most importantly, they discover and train the next generation of broadcasters. For more information on the MAEB and its affiliates, visit www.maeb.org.
Henry Ford Community College and Oakwood Healthcare are proud sponsors of the 2011 Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisan Market is open Fridays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. now through October 28th and is located next to the Bryant Library on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. For more information, call 313-673-4207. That's 313-673-4207. Or visit online at www.DearbornFarmersArtisansMarket.com. WHFR.FM is a proud media sponsor of the 19th Annual Concert of Colors. This free 4-day diversity festival featuring tons of live music will take place July 14th through the 17th. For performance times and locations or any additional information, visit www.concertofcolors.com. That's www.concertofcolors.com.
Hey cats, get hip to the jive with the hottest and the coolest swing tunes every Monday on Swing Time, 1 p.m. till 4. The big bands, the small groups, the new swing. Check it all out on Swing Time, Monday, 1 p.m. till 4, and jump on that jive.
Jim Jab Jump is a solid jive.
Makes you 9 foot tall when you're 4 foot five.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What do you get when you take a bunch of public radio nerds and shut them in a room with computer geeks? Well, in addition to some bizarrely socially awkward offspring, you get the Public Radio Player. It's a new iPhone app that streams hundreds of public radio stations, including this one, straight to your iPhone and iPod Touch. You can get more information at publicradioplayer.org.
WHFR, Dearborn.
It's Wednesday afternoon. What are you listening to? The answer should be the Midday Mix. I'm Melissa. I host an indie rock and jam band show once a week on Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. You should check it out. Right here on the only station making waves, WHFR.FM, or at www.WHFR.FM on the internet. Come on, it'll be fun.
They ask for more. What do you think this fan club is for?
Hi, this is Go Mike Holloway reminding all of you loyal listeners to tune in to the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway Show every Tuesday afternoon, 4 to 6 p.m., right here on WHFR.FM. The station that is always making waves.